Welcome to Veterans Connected, where maintenance and reliability expert and military veteran Eric Bevavino connects with fellow veterans in industry during each episode, exchanging their experiences and discussing the transition from the military to industry and the resources that led them to where they are today. The Veterans Connected podcast is proudly produced by the industry's leading network and learning community, Mobius Connect. Eric, over to you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Eric Bevavino, host of the Mobius Connect podcast focused on connecting military veterans to the maintenance and reliability community. Our aim here is to bridge the understanding gap between the military and civilian worlds, thereby improving the veteran transition experience and ultimately providing hope and a helping hand to any of our brothers and sisters out there struggling to find their way. We'll do this by interviewing veterans who have successfully made it through. For this session, we've chosen to interview one such Marine Corps veteran, Derek Abbey, whose fascinating and patriotic story is a must listen for anyone interested in joining us on this mission. Hey, Derek, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to join you, Eric. I'm excited for our conversation.
Yeah, me too. Where are you calling in from today?
I am in Bend, Oregon, just on the eastern slope of the Cascades, right in the middle of the state of Oregon.
Nice. Is that where you grew up?
I grew up in the Seattle area, but was an undergrad down in Oregon at Oregon State University. I used to come to Bend from time to time when I was in college. And when I came back to the Pacific Northwest, I wanted to go to the drier side of the mountains, if you will. And that's how I ended up in Bend. It's an outdoor paradise. And so I spent a lot of time in the outdoors when I'm here.
Nice. So you're an Oregon duck. Is that correct?
Oh, no.
Or a beaver.
You're the beaver. I'm a proud.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
I just went to the Super Regional last night. The Beavers made it to the College World Series. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Nice. The Ducks did not, I will say that.
So I can speak freely about the football uniforms of the Oregon Ducks, which are just, I think, too over the top for college football, if there is such a thing. You know, I'm a Big Ten guy, Penn State. And that bright green just really, it's a little offensive.
Yeah, they are.
Yes. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say they attract young students, though, and great football players, and
they've done
something right. And but of course, I don't have anything nice to say about the University of Oregon. I think.
Right on. Well, and interesting side note, you know, the nickname given to me by my dive school proctor in 1990, since he couldn't pronounce my last name of Bevavino, was Beaver. So I became Deep Sea Beaver. Oh. And I tried to shed that nickname for my entire career, but I kept going on ops with former dive school colleagues of mine who just, you know, brought it back, but just continued it. I just couldn't get rid of it. So I finally just got the tattoo and
gave it. I love it.
Right on. So, Derek, we were introduced by retired U.S. Navy master diver John Klukas, who I interviewed for this podcast in mid-May, and he gave you the highest recommendation as our next guest. So after reviewing your bio and speaking to you over the Zoom, I agree your story is quite interesting and it seems like a perfect fit for this show. Let's start by learning about how you and John met. How did you guys connect?
Well, John's an incredible individual. So, you know, having that recommendation means a lot to me. I became connected to John through my work in the MIA community. You know, now I run the organization Project Recover. And this was, more than 20 years ago, our organization located the B-24 in Palau that had 8 MIAs on board, 3 that had gotten off. And John was active duty Navy. And was on the recovery effort to recover those service members. It was an underwater crash site. And so John became connected with our organization. And then that bond was just kind of there for years. And as we grew our organization and expanded our capabilities underwater, John was just an incredible sounding board and really helped us grow it in a responsible, professional way. You know, we've leaned into him for his guidance quite a bit over the years, and we owe a great debt to his expertise in helping us grow our underwater capability as an organization. And so, you know, he's an incredible professional, but also an incredible human. He likes wrestling. I like wrestling. So when we found ourselves in barges in the middle of the Pacific, and we've had conversations about wrestling and other things like that. But yeah, just a great person and professional colleague.
Fantastic. And so tell us more about Project Recover then.
Yeah.
MIAs,
Yeah.
you've already said, with the association that John Underwater
Easy.
Recoveries, so
Yeah.
you have diving capabilities. Was there somebody from Project Recover on the Monitor expedition, or was that the, I think it may have been,
No, not that one. We worked with some folks that were on that expedition, but no Project Recover members. But our organization has been around in some capacity now for more than 3 decades, and our mission is to locate American service members missing in action from our previous wars, to return them to their families, provide answers to those families that have waited far too long. But one, we are a nonprofit organization, and we conduct proactive research, search missions, documentation of sites, and recovery efforts in both the underwater environment and the terrestrial environment related to MIA cases. And we're also a partner of the Department of Defense, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. So they'll also reach out to us to conduct any piece of that mission at any time. So, yeah, we've had a lot of success over the years in locating service members, and that success and impact just continues to grow. And John was an incredible part of that as we were growing the underwater capability. But our mission just continues to grow, it seems like, every single day.
Wow, and is there like a number, like a general number of MIA cases
Yeah,
to start culling through and
yeah.
prioritizing and figuring out which ones you can maybe get to and which ones you can't?
The number is bigger than most people know. So going back to World War II, there's 81,000 American service members that remain missing in action. That doesn't include a lot of training losses that take place off of our coasts and our Great Lakes and our mountains. They're also missing, but not necessarily designated missing in action. But probably the more important number is what that translates to, and that translates to as many as 5 million Gold Star MIA family members across the country that are waiting to learn what happened with their loved one, and dealing with that ambiguous loss over decades. And so we do what we can to provide answers to those, and we've been working hard on this mission for a long time. Started in the country of Palau in the South Pacific. We would do, self-funded missions, one mission a year for about 4 weeks, combing the jungles and the waters of Palau. And now we're doing multiple missions a year all over the world. We've been to 25 different countries. Have a team right now in Chuuk, doing some work. Another heading out to Vietnam later. We'll be back in Palau this year. We'll be in Italy. We're just in Germany. So it just continues to grow. And the impact is pretty incredible. A lot of people, ask us all the time, do families, do they still care after all this time? And 100%, they absolutely do. Even those relatives that never had an opportunity to meet that person that went missing. The grieving process when somebody goes missing is different than when somebody's killed in action. And we've seen that process interrupted, but then the grief passed from generation to generation to generation. And they kind of fill the void of the unknown with stories. And then that grief is passed on. This person is a myth. And when you're able to provide answers to that, you get to witness the healing within the family. When they have that, the grief process picks up as if it was just yesterday, and they're able to kind of move on with some sort of closure, but definitely some healing.
Yeah, the trauma of not knowing,
Yeah.
right, for so long, and maybe even hoping that they'll wander out of the jungle someday, and here we are. But yeah.
Every family we talk to has a story like that, that, somehow they survived, and they obviously have amnesia. Maybe they were rescued by natives, or they're living another life. But once they get their memory back, they'll return to their families and loved ones. And it doesn't matter how slim, that hope is, they hold on to that. And when somebody passes away that we love, a couple things happen. One, we have ceremony around it, whatever your background or your culture is, to recognize that loss. But then also this unspoken role changing occurs within the family unit. But when somebody goes missing, they hold on to that hope that they're going to return. So a ceremony doesn't occur. but also role changing doesn't occur, and there's that void just remains there. And it's been pretty incredible to witness over the years. You know, I've had the honor of interacting with hundreds, if not thousands, of family members now, and it's just there's a lot of similar themes across these families, and also similar themes when you see somebody brought home, and what happens to that family unit when they finally have those answers.
Wow, fantastic, impactful work. And wait, how did you find this? Like, what was the trail of maybe your upbringing or your military career that led to being the president and CEO of Project Recover?
I wish I could say it was, you know, fully intentional the whole way. But, even though I've been doing it for now more than 20 years, and I've been in the present CEO role for about 6 years now, it kind of just aligns with my general philosophy in life. But I became connected to it through our founder, Dr. Pat Scannon. And this was, again, more than 20 years ago. I was an active duty Marine. I was serving in a fighter squadron. And I had just come back from a Middle East deployment, and we got a random phone call to the ready room. And I ended up talking to this World War II veteran on the other end of the line who was trying to gather names and coordinate for a reunion that year. And I didn't have any really information to provide him, but I just asked, you know, can I come out and join you guys for a reunion?
Yeah.
And he's like, yes, absolutely. And so me and another a guy from the squadron took a Hornet out and met with a World War II cadre. And they're like, this is amazing. Tell us about F-18s and the Middle East. And we're like, who cares about that? Tell us about World War II and Corsairs. And they're like, who cares about that? And it was just a connection across time with fellow Marines. But at that time, Pat would go to these reunions and interview veterans to gather information related to losses, but also provide updates to them. And him and I missed each other by about 20 minutes that year, because we had to get back west with the jet. But I worked with the cadre to schedule the next reunion and bring them to San Diego. And we had the old squadron and the new squadron together. And Pat and I met that year. And him and I became fast friends. He invited me to be a part of the organization. I accepted, of course. It just seemed like the right thing to do. I was deploying quite a bit at the time, so it took me a while to get on my first mission. But I finally made it, came back from another Middle East deployment, unpacked a sea bag, packed a suitcase, met the team in Palau. And that year we had an MIA discovery. We found a site, and it turned out that it was a Marine from my squadron from World War II.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So as you can imagine,
serendipitous,
I was
really.
At that point,
at that.
Yeah. And just in the organization, became a team lead. And then as a nonprofit group, became a board member. And then about 6 years ago, they asked me to take over as president and CEO. And so it's just been amazing to participate, to be a part of, to be, you know, connected to these incredible people that execute this mission, and now to help, you know, establish a vision and lead them into the future is very special to me.
Absolutely. Pretty incredible sequence of events.
Yeah.
I mean, not only just being the guy that picks up the phone when Pat called, right? And not being in too much of a hurry to sort of be curious about, you know, who's this guy and what's he up to, and then being able to orchestrate, you know, volunteering to go out and meet and learn and listen, and then coordinate the squad, and then to find somebody from the squad. That's your first job.
Yeah, right. I mean, you couldn't have, it's like writing a book or something like that.
Right.
We've had so many, you know, coincidences over the years. We no longer call them coincidences or serendipity. We call them angel taps. Like, you know, somebody's telling you something. We don't know who it is, but you should be listening. And so many things have happened over the years like that, it's just, it's a special organization, and there's special people within it. That's for sure.
Without a doubt, the universe conspires to help the ones it loves. I suspect, or maybe even the ones who don't, but you got to be open to it, and you got to be able to listen. So very cool. So you told us a little bit about the squadron, the Hornets and stuff like that. But since we've spoken before, I know there are some different nuances to your military career. Let's segue into that. What did you start in the Marines?
Yeah.
And where did you end up?
I always joke that if we were, you know, a couple of veterans in the in the bar and having a few drinks, and I was talking about my career, you'd probably think, yeah, have another. Yeah, sure, that you're. But I had a fairy tale career. I like to say, I got a lot out of the Marine Corps, and they certainly got a lot out of me. But I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle area, and when I was 13, my mom unfortunately passed away.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was unexpected, and she was there one day and gone the next. But as a 13-year-old, you can imagine, your life's turned upside down. She's a single parent, and so I was really left without a rudder or sail, and just kind of making my way through life. And I just felt like I needed an escape, a way to prove myself. I wish I could say that I knew I was seeking out a system and a structure that I could succeed in, but ultimately, I ran away to the Marine Corps when I was 17. I signed up and I was like, this seems like a challenge to me. It seems like a way for me to prove myself, to give back. And, I thought, I'll do a few years and then we'll figure out from there. Well, it was a little bit more than that. So I enlisted right out of high school. I was a communicator initially, and this was right after Desert Storm, Desert Shield. I actually signed up for the delayed enlistment program the month that Saddam Hussein crossed over into Kuwait, but by the time I got into the fleet, that conflict was long over. Yeah,
Didn't
I did.
last very long.
No, 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 no. I did my first tour as a Marine enlisted communicator, and then at the end of that tour, I was selected for a commissioning program, and the Marine Corps actually sent me to Oregon State to get an undergrad degree. So, went to Oregon State, studied history, got a couple degrees in history. Finished and was commissioned a ground officer, and all Marine officers have to go to the basic schools to learn how to be a junior level officer, and that's when you'll get your job MOS, if you will. And while I was there, a lieutenant asked if I was interested in flying at all one night, and I really didn't know why he was asking, and we went back and forth for a bit, and I was like, okay, sure, I guess I might be interested. He's like, all right, tomorrow you have to go take this test at 1800 or whatever, and I was just like, oh man, I just gave up my Wednesday evening. But I walked in, and it was the aviation aptitude exam, and I took it over the next few hours and came in the next morning. They said, you passed, go take your flight physical. Went and took my flight physical, and they said, you're going to Pensacola. And I actually went back and forth to with my boss, and I was like, I don't think this is what I want to do. I got commissioned to be a ground officer. I've been in school for 4 years. I'm ready to get back to the fleet and lead Marines. And he's like, well, the Marine Corps wants you to go to flight school. And so I went to flight school. I was selected to be a naval flight officer, and said, well, if I'm going to do that, I want F-18s, I want West Coast F-18s. And so I succeeded in flight school, and I got what I wanted, F-18s on the West Coast. And while I was in flight school, 9/11 happened, and I'm kind of missing out on, you want to prove yourself as a Marine and show that you can do your job, and
Sure.
or I didn't want to be. But by the time I got into the Hornet rag, where you learn the specifics about the Hornet, we knew we were going to be going to Iraq, and so me and a few others got fast tracked and joined our squadron and deployed right away. And then I ended up being over Iraq when OIF kicked off, and did three tours to Iraq, one to the Far East in the F-18. I like to say I did everything you possibly want to do in the F-18, except for an actual air-to-air engagement. But my favorite mission was close air support, when Marines and other American service members and allies on the ground when they were in really tight spots. But the OIF-1 did the whole Fallujah campaign, the first elections, and several other things. And then as I was on, finishing up my last deployment in the Hornet, I was up for orders, and I knew I wanted to go do something extensive on the ground, and they were creating what is now Marine Special Operations Command. And so I was selected to go to what's now First Raider Battalion. Became a placeholder with that battalion when we stood that up, and got to work with some more amazing people and do some Smurf Ninja stuff with some for a few years, and some more deployments. And then towards the end of that, I was trying to figure out if I was going to stay in the Special Operations community or go back to the F-18 community, and I was actually selected for the advanced degree program. So the Marine Corps sent me back to college to get another degree. And I ended up doing the real sexy thing of running a schoolhouse as my Twilight Tour in North Carolina. I ran the train. Like I said, it was NFL career, they got a lot out of me, and I got a lot out of the Marine Corps, and I owe everything in my life right now to my service in the Marine Corps.
Well, fantastic. Great career. Congratulations on that. Thank you for everything you've done. I mean, standing up the Raiders, I mean, that was pretty intense, right? Because there was there no sort of underwater special forces. I mean, they're not fully, not totally always underwater, but you're like on the water. I mean,
Yeah, well, it's
the
an amphibian.
Marines come from the water
Yeah.
to the beach, right? So, yeah.
Well, the Marine Corps has always had our reconnaissance community and our force reconnaissance community, and
Okay.
so they've always, or for a long time, have had a special operations mission, specifically on our Muse, and they've worked ex extensively with Special Operations Command and others, but they never had an official branch like the Army, the Navy, Air Force within SOCOM. And so when we created the MARSOC, basically initially we just took down the force flag and put up the Mars flag, MARSOC flag, and said, now you're, and it's like, oh, more money. And then when I was there, it was really just a matter of, okay, we're going to figure out what Marine Special Operations is and build out the schoolhouse and everything, and add the unique culture of the Marine Corps to it. And even the whole time I was there, we were still trying to figure it out, but they've obviously done a really good job now, and the schoolhouse is absolutely incredible. They're creating amazing operators, and the Raiders are going out and doing some amazing things, and have definitely proven themselves within the special operations community, just as they had when it was force reconnaissance performing in the special operations community.
Nate. So at what age then were you put onto that plank owner team, and what role did you have as a, were you a junior officer or mid-grade officer at that time?
I was a senior captain, so I was
Okay.
but I was an older guy because I had a prior enlisted
Sure. More
background.
experience.
So
Yeah.
when I first got there, they put me in the battalion air officer role while the companies were being stood up, and then I went to Delta Company, the first Delta Company that stood up, and was their air officer. And then after some changeover, ended up becoming the executive officer of the company when we were deployed. And so, yeah, I was the liaison with the aviation and all those things, and training the Marines to become JTACs and qualifying them to be JTACs. And yeah, and then they went and performed, and we performed and did some incredible stuff overseas. I compare it very closely to a ready room. The team room is a lot like the ready room in my mind, and I'm sure a lot like a dive locker,
Sure,
where you have a lot of type A personalities, overachievers. These are the cream of the crop, and they don't put up with mediocrity. And so I just loved the environment. It seemed like it was just, if you would have just told me, oh, this is a team room and it was a ready room, I probably wouldn't know the difference, except for the fancy chairs that we have in ready rooms and things like that. Just the difference in gear, really. But same mindset, same approach to the mission, and they did it well. So,
same twisted sense of humor from high risk operators.
yep, you're out there risking your life every day, and so you have that dark humor that you bring back, and yeah, that was definitely consistent across those.
Right on. I think I first realized the kinship between pilots and divers, at least when I got my first staff job for CNFJ, and there were probably as many pilots as surface. I mean, a lot of officers, a lot of people in general. I think we had like 120 people in that unit. But yeah, the only people that would laugh at my jokes were the aviators. So I'm like, oh, what's this about? And then we ended up going out to lunch together and then drinking together. I'm like, okay, this is all right. But yeah,
Well,
good
I've had the
times.
honor of working with many Navy divers now, and other services divers as well. And yeah, there's definitely a bond across that, and an understanding of how you approach the mission and how you approach life in general. John being one of them, but he's introduced me to many others that have not only supported our mission, but just the camaraderie of working alongside.
Yeah, work hard, play hard,
Oh, yeah.
accountable to your to your squad, your buddies, to your chain of command and everything like that. So that's neat. So you were a senior captain probably in your 30s.
Yeah, I was definitely in my 30s. And I know I hit 35 when I was there because we had a joke about, because our leadership in the company, we were all 35 and older. And so we joked that our call sign was Rusty Dagger because you have the special operations community. And and so we were
team. That's funny, Dagger. Yeah.
And so my company commander, who's a dear friend of mine and actually works with Project Recover, and we work on it seems like a lot of things together, Brian Herbulis. When he finished up that tour, got him a humidor and had carved in there Rusty Dagger as a reminder of the room. So yeah,
that's awesome. So that experience, so really the structure, so you came in, you filled a spot within the structure and then helped sort of stand it up with like the, I guess, commissioning crew or the inaugural crew, and then, you know, made that work at the design that was provided, right? Was there any,
yeah, I
was
wish
there
I
any changes
a
through
lot
that?
Of influence on the,
yeah, yeah.
On the structure of the command and things like that. Mostly I provided, you know, the specific expertise within the field, and then provided the training and the expertise to grow that part of the community. And I, of course, I wasn't the only one. I think there was 8 of us or so with aviation when we stood up, or ultimately ended up being 8. And on the structure wise and how we're going to, you know, build out the unit, I didn't have a voice in that. Really.
Well, they usually don't give those jobs to, you know, that type of stuff to the 30-year-old NCOs or officers, even at 35, right? So that doesn't surprise me, but it's interesting though. So in that role, or any of your roles, how important were the maintenance practices as well as the training practices and really getting ready for real life missions?
Well, it's as important as life and death, you know. I mean, if you think about the aviation side, we're flying around in a, you know, $50 million aircraft and expected to support, you know, folks on the ground that are in really tight spots. And so first, you know, the aircraft has to fly to keep the crew members alive. And then it's not just a transport aircraft. This is a weapon of war. And so, and it has to perform at the highest level. This is a supersonic, fighter jet. And so has to employ ordnance, has all sorts of equipment on it, and it has to be airborne and take off and land safely. And so, you know, you had 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old experts in their field keeping those jets put together. And when we were deployed, they were working non-stop in very austere conditions, and they had to do their job well, and they did it very, very well. And if they didn't do it well, then you have air crew that might lose their life, or if we can't perform and get the jet where it needs to be and support where it needs to be, well, then any number of American service members and allies might lose their life on the ground. And so reliability is life and death. I mean, how much more important is that? And the maintenance of those aircraft is the most important. That's one of the senior roles within a squadron, is the maintenance department, because it's so important. And and then, you know, when it comes to training and, you know, just maintenance of your own personal gear, if you kind of think about the work that we were doing on the ground in the special operations community, from, you know, your radios and keeping those up to speed, but also the training that we were doing, and I kind of outlined earlier, like working with these Marines to make sure that they're capable of working with aircraft and communicating clearly with those aircraft so that they can provide that support that they need. You know, there's all sorts of things. If the Swiss cheese lines up, then things can go bad really, really quick. And that could be as simple as a dead battery in a radio, or it's not, PM'd correctly or something like that, or you weren't an expert in your training, and you make a mistake in communicating. So all that stuff, the maintenance of your gear, the maintenance of just being a professional and be tactically proficient is vital in every single piece. And there's just, one link in the chain breaks and people lose their life. And so yeah, it was very important in every single task that I had.
Pretty important. Does like one specific challenge come to mind from the war zone? I mean, you were in Iraq. Were you in flying over Afghanistan as well while you were over
Yeah,
there?
I flew in Iraq multiple times, never deployed the jet to Afghanistan, but I was in Afghanistan on the ground. And I can think of a great example of it. And it seems kind of, I mean, it's almost comical since I survived now.
Yeah, right. It's only funny if you made it out.
We were taking off for a mission in Iraq, the middle of summer. It was, I don't know, 100 and whatever degrees outside. And as we're rolling down the runway, the left main tire on the jet just shredded at rotation. And so the most dangerous part of any flight is takeoff and landing when you're close to the ground, right? You have a limited number of options. We ended up taking the jet airborne. Actually didn't know what happened when the tire shredded, but half of it got sucked down the engine, and kept up. Kept flying. It was incredible. And then had the wingman come over and check out, and they told us what happened. But now we didn't know, is it just a piece of metal sticking out there in your gear, or is there anything left of the tire or what? So we had to, one, get rid of all of our gas, and then, bring the jet back to the runway, take a trap when you catch a wire like you do on a ship, because it's an emergency. But I was thinking when we were coming in for that landing that it's like, oh, well, we're going 140 knots, surrounded by about 10,000 pounds of explosive, not including fuel and all that stuff. It goes south really, really fast. But ended up having a safe trap, and nothing bad happened except for the loss of a $4 million engine and however much it cost to fix that flap. But now all those maintainers had to go back and fix it. Now, this wasn't actually a fault of maintenance. This was a fault of the purchasing side of things, and we discovered that the Navy was purchasing, for lack of a better term, retread tires and putting them on these jets, while the tread wasn't holding up in the heat of the desert. And so that's where the failure occurred, and it happened again a second time, not as bad as ours. And then they just stopped putting those retread tires. But that's just something where, it doesn't seem like a big deal. Oh, you lose a tire, you get a flat, whatever. While it was money-wise, it was a big deal, and we weren't able to conduct that mission. And I don't think it was a very dynamic day. But if there were Marines or somebody else in trouble, and we were trying to get to them to support them, well, now that asset isn't there, and they have to figure out a new way out of the pinch that they're in. And so, yeah, that's one I think back on all the time, where it's like, ooh, that could have been really, really bad. I mean, it was bad, but
Right. It's,
a lot
luckily, it
worse than the
didn't
whole
go
jet
worse.
and a couple of air crew. So.
Yeah, I can almost hear the groans of our listeners. When you mentioned procurement or purchasing, we saved a couple dollars on this tire retread, wouldn't stand up to the heat. Here we are with a situation where the thing is peeling off, going through the engine. And creating a, I mean, what would have happened if there was like an urgent need? You guys would have just gone and then figured it out on the way back. Is that what would have happened? Or
No, because we didn't know. I mean,
because the engine could have failed, right?
the
Or
tire got
something.
sucked down the engine, so had no idea
Right.
form. And I
Would
mean,
have made
just
it worse.
I remember, like, what I remember from the incident was the tire flying by the canopy. I mean, if the tire would have hit the canopy, who knows
Oh, it
what.
was the front, like the nose tire or
It threw the
something.
tire forward, and we blasted by it, and we both
Oh,
were,
okay.
what was that? And it was at rotation, so the most dangerous part of the mission, if I mean, all sorts of different things could have happened, and we could have just augured in off the end of the runway with a full bag of gas and a bunch of explosives, and that wouldn't have been a bad day, or that would have been a bad day actually for us.
Really bad day for sure. Well, interesting. I mean, yeah, the relatability. Yeah, so if you're a Marine raider or aviation guy, and it's life or death and maintenance and procurement and stuff, corporate America may not be the place for you because the vortex of mediocrity is strong, and if the alignment between operations, maintenance, and procurement, whether it's in a tire manufacturing plant, retread plant, a power plant, whatever, if that alignment isn't tight, it can be life and death at a refinery or an assembly line
Well,
or a
even
power
our
plant.
mission
Yeah.
today, the mission that we do, that I do with Project Recover, isn't a safe one. You're
Sure.
traipsing through the jungle somewhere and somebody falls and breaks a bone. Well, now you have to get them out of there. Or what do you have to get those people out of there? And same thing if it's a water mission, as a diver, we're looking at all that stuff and trying to minimize any potential risk. You can't eliminate all the risk though. It's just part of the job. Just like there's always risk in flying, there's always risk in the special operations community. But that, taking care of your gear, making sure that everything is, you've minimized the risk as much as possible so that people can execute. It's something that I still deal with every single day.
Yeah, and working at a nonprofit is a little bit of a flip of the coin too, right? You come from the Defense Department, which has seemingly unlimited funds depending on who you are and what you do. And then you go to a nonprofit where there are not unlimited funds and every nickel counts. So having not only a backup, two is one and one is none, where in the military you may have three. I mean, you maybe have one and a half there, or how does that work?
You hope
Yeah.
that you have, it's a different leadership challenge. That's one of the biggest things, is that you don't have the structure and stratification of the Department of Defense behind you and executing. You have to have buy-in from the people that are executing and trust across the board. You can't just lean into whatever your rank is because
Sure. Yeah.
not enough people, not enough equipment, not enough money. And so it's always it's a leadership challenge to make sure that people are bought in and that they understand the value of the mission. Ours is pretty straightforward. It's pretty easy to get people to buy in. Sometimes it's a little bit of a challenge for them to understand some of the nuance and things like that about how to get things done, especially if you're coming from the military side of things, because you can't just bulldoze your way through some things like you might. And also we work in foreign countries and we work there with their permission. We can't just be like, hey, we're big Department of Defense and you're welcome that we're here, type of thing.
Yeah, right. Get out of the way.
How can we get your permission to execute this mission and stuff like that? So that's one of the big things. But yes, and then it is a big challenge to like, okay, do we have enough to make sure that we're doing this right? But bringing in the right people is always really, really important, who understand how to do things as safe as possible and be the professionals that they are.
Right on. Very interesting. Well, if people want to learn more about Project Recovery, sorry, Project Recover, the website, I mean, it just sort of slips out, but yeah, is a lot more information online. I would take it, I guess, then.
So projectrecover.org is our website, and you can sign up for our newsletter, get all the updates on the repatriations and the folks that were signed, as pl plenty of other stories and things like that. Learn about things that we have coming up and all, but everything can be done at projectrecover.org. Another big thing is if you have an MI in your family, we want to hear about that, and you never know, you might have a piece of information that would be valuable to us to hopefully find that person. We can never make any promises, but you never know. And we are a volunteer-based organization, so we're always looking for people to become members of the organization. Right now, we are on a pause because we've had a lot of success and we've been flooded with members, and I got to get some new members into the field and get them comfortable with the mission. But if you sign up for our newsletter, then we'll give you the updates of when we're opening back up and bringing on new team members. But you might have an expertise that we are just looking for, you never know. It used to be we always wanted divers, but now we're looking for people that have unique skill sets that might help us advance the mission in a new way. And I'm always looking for new innovative ways to execute this mission, and that really helps them own it. So if they're divers, great. But if they're not, they might be archaeologists or forensic anthropologists or medical experts, or who knows what kind of expertise that they might bring to the fight. And we want to hear from you.
Well, even like historians, right? Or
Yeah,
somebody
the full-time
who's.
historian. We're actually getting ready to hire another researcher right now. That person will be located in the DC area to help us advance some areas of research that we're really, really excited about.
Cool. I suspect it'd be a great place for veterans to go to work.
It's a
No.
it we have a lot of members that are not veterans, and you don't have
Okay.
to be a veteran, but of course,
Patriotic. Yeah.
well, and then just the leave no one behind mentality of the military. There's this additional connection to the mission in searching for, those fellow service members that were lost. And so you also don't have to be American. We have members all over the country that are just attracted to the humanness of this mission and want to play a part of it. And yeah, like I said, it's a special mission. It's a special team, special people. And every time I take a new team to the field, I always pause and kind of look around the room and go, how the heck did we get these incredible people here? And then of course the imposter syndrome creeps in. I'm going to figure out I'm just a knucklehead Marine and kick me out of here. But hasn't happened yet.
Nice. Leadership trumps all.
I hope so.
Well, and trust. Yeah, doesn't trump trust. Can't have one without the other, and it's important. I think the small unit tactics and well, small unit relationships and operations and aviation and stuff like that really hones in on the trust factor, which is fantastic and helps. I'm sure it helps you quite a bit in that role. All right, Derek. So back to this transition thing. How was your transition out of the military? Was it so you told the story about how you met Pat and
Yeah.
how you became friends, and that happened sounded organically. So it doesn't sound like you were retired out of the military, and you're like, here's my resume. How the heck do I figure out what I'm going to do? It just kind of flowed for you, right?
Well, there were things that went well, and there were things that
Okay, right on.
stuff
Tell me
went.
more.
I was
Yeah.
really lucky. I mentioned that I had those 2 times that the Marine Corps sent me to college for my undergrad and then my master's. And those were opportunities where I kind of had 1 foot in and 1 foot out of the military and the safety net of having a paycheck. And so I had experienced some of the transition friction along the way. But at the same time, there's always, some friction around it. The good thing was, is I was really kind of my first jobs out of the military, I was still volunteering with Project Recover, but I worked in higher education, and I was actually researching transition theory and things like that and adult development stuff. And so when
Oh, okay.
I explored, the experience of military members when they're leaving the service. And I did that intentionally because I was really curious. I took a step back and with all the veterans that I was working with, and was like, when we were in the military, we were transitioning all the time. And the civilian sector,
One command to the next, one role to the next. Yeah.
and it's, civilian sector is not a stagnant environment either. People are going through transition all the time. And so I was really curious what was so unique about the transition from active service to back to the civilian sector. And so it really dove into, this piece of with identity, intimate relationships that you get from the military system. And then also this, people call it purpose. Many times they kind of have the shallow definition, or they throw the word around a lot, but you can use words like generativity or impact on the world or legacy or things like that. And one of the biggest challenges I realized and discovered was, this newfound self-efficacy that you have after you leave the service. And I noted that the people that were harnessing that early were having more success. people that were exploring, well, who am I besides Derek the Marine? And then owning those new success, those that could develop relationships with others outside of the military and have realistic expectations of those people, but also open lines of communication with them were doing better. And then finally, those that were saying, okay, you know, when I was in the military, you're provided your mission, right? You're provided your purpose. Nobody's going to tell you what it is. And so it's difficult for a lot of people to step out of that system and then wait for the mission to come to them. But those that say, okay, this is who I am now, forever be Derek the Marine, I'm a veteran, but now my new quote-unquote mission statement in this world is X, and this is how I'm going to fill that mission statement. And so just simple things like awareness to that really helped my own transition. But it's, again, it's not always easy. I mean, you get under stress and you kind of start thinking like, wow, what is the impact that I'm creating for the world? You know, if you get down in the dumps, it's exacerbated by other things that might have happened. And obviously that adds to the difficulty. But I did note that, you know, when I got out and I was just like, okay, this is how I'm going to create an impact on the world. And that's been through Project Recover and the MIA community and Gold Star MIA families. But then it's also been in the higher education environment and helping not only veterans access and find success in higher education, but then also just working within higher education in general. That's something actually that's been really special with my experiences. Initially, I was focused on the veteran community, but then through working with that, I was able to kind of expand that influence to more of the general community as well. And so just continuously looking on how to expand that sphere of influence in a positive way is something that I have personally done that just aligns with my own mission statement, which is just very simple. I want to have a positive impact on as many people as I can across my lifetime. And these are the areas where I find that I can create that impact.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And so I didn't realize that I'm glad I asked the question. I'm glad we went over it, and you probably have, you were thinking about this ahead of time, which is great. But it makes a lot of sense that, really being analytical or interested in like, okay, well, I'm going to go through this transition. Let's figure out what's happening. So the question that came to mind for me, because I went through my transition in 1994, that was first, and then I stayed in the reserves until about 2014. So that was like retirement, you know, in my mid 40s, late 40s, whatever. And anyway, there was no like Honor Foundation at that point. And did you go through the Honor Foundation? Were you eligible?
I was eligible, but they were just starting. And actually, I was in San Diego, and I was working at San Diego State when Joe was starting the Honor Foundation. And what initially it was, you know, just SEALs, and then it grew across the entire special operations community. But phenomenal program, and they're doing great work. And then there's some others out there that are also doing some great work as well. But no, I didn't have program to go through myself. And, but you know, I said that there were moments when I had one foot in, one foot out. And when I went in 1995, when I got sent to Oregon State to get my degree, I was an active Marine, but I was a student. I was, you know, dealing with that. And my first year in college there was a lot of friction. And now I look back on it, it was the same experience that a lot of folks experience when they're going through transition. And I didn't have realistic expectations of the fellow students around me. And so that would create, I'd get all frustrated about that. And then finally, about a year into it, I was like, what are you getting all upset about? Why is all this happening? And kind of just,
and nobody else is upset, but you,
I was
Twizzlers during the class, and you
right. Oh, I mean, you, all the stuff, you know, all the stuff where I'm like, oh man, I worked really hard to get here, and I got to perform at a high level because now the Marine Corps standard is my standard. And then seeing other people that just didn't have the same standard, and then allowing that to really frustrate me and get under my skin. And it's like, what? You know, that's their life. That's not your life. You know,
yeah.
They're not
perspective.
You.
Yeah.
Why are you getting all bent out of shape about it? Just focus on the things that you can control and things like that. But, you know, and now have worked in higher education and worked with thousands of veterans and watched them experience the same thing, you know, and then just encourage them like, oh, you know, that person that you're getting frustrated with, they could probably help you with their math, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, find a common area where you can connect with instead of what you're worried about being frustrated about. And you could probably, you know, help them as well. Instead of just, you know, poo-pooing them all the time, you probably have some knowledge and some skills that they could find value in, but let's have a conversation. And also in that, if you're having conversation, you're breaking down all these, you know, stereotypes that people have about what a veteran represents, that they only know from the media because we have a shrinking military population and things like that. And so there's all sorts of good that you can do just from like, oh, okay, you know, why am I getting upset about this? And like, oh, you know, there's some connection we can make. And then that's going towards that, those relationships that I mentioned earlier. They don't have the same experience, but you can develop intimate relationships with people that weren't in the military. And when I say intimate, I don't mean romantic. I just mean really trust and strong.
Yeah, deep friendships and whatnot. Yeah,
and going back
to
that trust that you mentioned earlier, where in the military we have shared experience, shared hardship, shared challenges. You know, we many times certain environments were proving ourselves to be there at a very, very high standard. You know, it's hard to mimic that. And it's, there's not too many cases in the civilian sector where you go through the same experience and you don't have to, that's all right. You know, so it's like, we don't,
yeah, that's right. Doesn't make them,
yeah.
It doesn't make us better or worse. It doesn't make them better or worse. It's just, you know, just is what it is. And the reason I thought about the Honor Foundation, because the process that you were talking about of, you know, really redefining your identity and your purpose in the transformation of service before self into whatever the next chapter is so vitally important that it is often missed through the regular transition process for non-special forces folks or whatever. But I've heard this multiple times, heard it, I think, first through some friends of mine who were EOD out there, Navy EOD, and then just continued research and it, going through my own transitions, just going from Navy reservist to retired reservist, going from corporate guy to, you know, independent contractor, consultant, whatever I am now, right? That type of thing, which, by the way, makes me very happy because I'm comfortable with that identity. And I wrote it all down and I, you know, did all the mind mapping and all the exercises because I like to do that kind of stuff. It sounds like you know, went through the same process. And yeah, that makes you even a more unique individual because you've studied the human behavior side of military transition and being able to confidently say, you know, transition is transition. I mean, you think of the big ones like graduating from high school, going into the military, or getting out of the military, graduating, going into college, graduating from college, getting married, having kids, you know, retirement, grandkids, that type of thing. But there's a lot of transitions in there. And if you take it down to, you know, Monday to Tuesday is a transition, or even, you know, noon to 1 o'clock is a transition. I mean, time marches on, brother. Time marches on, and we are always transitioning. So it's probably the biggest skill that anybody could have or refine or very worthy effort to think through it and to you know, kind of have your own process of how you.
Awareness is one thing, but then also having a few tools to like, okay, well, how can I address? But I discovered in working with, you know, fellow veterans, student veterans specifically for the most part, but, or just those going through transition, just having conversations about like, yeah, who are you besides Derek the Marine. You know, and then they're like, oh, I hadn't actually even thought about that.
Forces you to put in words,
are
which
you know, what are realistic expectations for you to have of your classmates? You know, and they're like, oh, and what realistic expectations should they have of you? And then they're kind of just asking those questions, and people, you almost see the light bulb come on. And then in the purpose one, I think that's the one that really, really scares people, because there's also this, you might fail, you might fall short in trying to accomplish it. And then from the military lens, you're like, well, that's not an option. Well, you're not, you know, it's not, it is an option actually outside of this, the military, and it happens often. And I'm not saying strive for failure, but every once in a while you're going to trip or you're going to fall short of what you want. And hopefully you can use that as a learning moment. And then just, you know, go even further from there. I remember I was on a plane reading Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, and failure came up in that. And for whatever reason, I decided to write down my failures and setbacks from the previous 5 years. And this is when I had been out, I think, of the military for 5 years. And I thought, oh, it'd be a, you know, I'll have a few things. And I ended up like a full page of stuff I had written down. And then when I was looking at it, I was like, man, those were really painful in the moment, but I wouldn't be here without this, or I wouldn't have been able to accomplish X without this setback. I wouldn't have learned this without this. And, you know, you don't really get that. I mean, I had some spots where I fell short in the military, and I can think about them, and they were definitely growth moments, but there wasn't that many. You know, definitely when it came to the mission, you know, executing the mission, you couldn't fail. Where I talk to my staff, you know, I mentioned, I'm like, I want innovation. And if you want innovation from people, they have to be able to trip. They have to fall short. And I say, fail fast and cheap, and then we'll move on from there. And then, of course, when they do fail and trip, they're going to look at you and see how you react. And, of course,
yeah,
freak out on them. Well, they'll never fail again, but they'll never be
there. Right. They do. You won't know about it. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Well, I mean, this is really important, the introspection. I mean, call it therapy, call it, you know, personal growth, call it whatever, but it's reframing some of the things that we, you know, are brought up with, perhaps. And if you're not brought up with an innovation mindset that it's okay to fail, or you're just so afraid to fail. I mean, I watch kids today. I have two teenage daughters, and of course we want them to succeed and we want them to do well, but we don't feel like we put any pressure on them. The pressure that they put on themselves is just, you can just see it on their faces. It's extraordinary. So yeah. It's more of telling, being good at communicating how they can lighten up, right, and be okay with it, and you can recover from this. And in your list of things, I mean, I think it also helps to figure out where the big ones, and one of the ones that are still bags in your or rocks in your rucksack that don't matter. Okay, learn from it. Doesn't matter. You know, move on, lighten that load and keep going. But fantastic. So that sounds like, perhaps, Derek, your advice to service members as they're transitioning and they're thinking about it. And anything else to add?
No, I would just say
that topic.
You know, I would encourage them to sit down and write out, you know, the impact that they want to create on the world. What's their new mission? And it's all right if you don't have it down, you know, but Rob Dial says it's okay not to know what your mission is, and I'm ad-libbing here, but yeah, it's not all right to be constantly striving to determine what that is. You know, harnessing that new self-efficacy is huge, because now you're using your own personal power to advance yourself through the next phase of your life. There's not going to be people there telling you, you know, what your mission is and when and where to execute. So you got to determine it on your own. And there will be some setbacks, and that's okay. Learn from them and then just keep on charging.
Sounds great. And trust the tools that the military gave you to
do some incredible tools, that's for sure.
Yeah. Help endure and think through the operational, maybe planning process, or if you were part of it, what worked. And yeah, Fantastic.
Be open to other ways of doing business too. One way, we teach different leadership styles in the military, but we really, really execute, traits-based leadership theory because of the structure and the mission of the military. But when you get out, I talked about a little bit with the nonprofit sector. I worked in nonprofit. I worked in higher ed. You never have enough people. You never have enough resources. And so how do you convince those folks to move beyond their position description? And it's not like in the military where it's like, I'm this rank, you're that rank. We're going to work until the job's done. And then we're going to come in on Saturday and Sunday as well. You do that in these places, they just look at you like you have a horn growing out of your head and they're like, find someone else to work. So you have to practice different leadership. And there are people that practice really quality leadership practices within the military, but being in a different system might discover that, like, oh, how I used to do things doesn't quite work the same way here. So what other tools can I add to that toolbox?
Yeah, right. Honing on the empathy and the generational differences and ways to communicate and listen and understand, and two ears, one mouth, a lot of listening.
Yeah. I'm all about developing buy-in, developing those relationships of trust so that it becomes their mission. Let them own it. And then you, just like in the service, people will run through a wall for you. If you have that trust and they have the buy-in, they want to succeed.
So. Right on. Right on. All right, Derek. So what advice would you give to people who are looking to hire veterans?
Not every veteran's created the same. So they come with some incredible skill sets that they learned in the military. And so I would, learn to read a little bit beyond the resume if you can. If it's like you can give them a benefit of doubt to bring them in for a interview where you may not have done it before, you might learn some pretty incredible things just because a lot of the times we have difficulty translating our experience from the military into the new position that we're doing. At the same time, sometimes, I did this. I applied for some positions when I was getting out of the military, and now I kind of look back and facepalm. I'm like, I can't believe I was not qualified for that job. But it's like, I think I could do this, all sorts of
right.
Kind of this.
How hard could it be?
Yeah. But my first job, it was definitely a step down in the higher education environment. But I could see that they were like, okay, we don't know what this Marine is, or is he going to come in here and start kicking walls down, or what's going to happen. And so I just showed up, checked my ego at the door, said, I'm here to paint. What color do you want? Type of approach, and just performed. And I think they were doing the same thing and looking at like, okay, we don't know really how this person's going to perform in this role, but I just excelled, and they learned about my value. And I also learned about my value and also how to better communicate that value to other people, especially in the higher education environment, but also in other environments. And so it just takes some time. And so, I think you discover that people that hire veterans tend to be very happy with those hires, and then they go back that well to get more and more and more. But it does take some time to learn about that value and become more familiar with it and comfortable with it. But then also to work with those veterans and give them the space to excel in those roles. And of course, as a veteran yourself, just check the ego and be that sponge when you come in. And you hear it all the time about, veterans change their jobs at a greater rate within the first year of after they get out. And I'm like, well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think I had three jobs within my first 2 years, but they were all moving up. So I figured out my value. I got a promotion, got another promotion. That's not a bad thing. Or you might go into something thinking, oh, this is really what I want to do. And then you get in there and you're like, yuck, this is not at all what I want to do. And so
right,
someplace else that's going to bring you greater joy, or you can excel in, and things like that. So there's that big learning period after you get out. That kind of answers the question from two different angles. But I think, understanding some of the intangibles that the veterans can bring into your organization, but then as a veteran too, checking the ego at the door and really learning what your value is and giving yourself some time to excel.
Yeah, that's actually all great points. The learning your value and, you know, gaining confidence once you get a kind of crawl, walk, run, right? You have to step off the ship, or the Zodiac in this case, right? Step off and then get on to the, you know, maybe the wet sand and then the dry sand, then the pavement or the rocks or the jungle or whatever. And then you can navigate a little bit better with confidence. Yeah.
You can go back to World War II and see research that's going back that far, 80 plus years, where I don't care if you did 2 years in the military or you did 30 years. It seems like every veteran feels like they're behind their peers based on these made up benchmarks that we put in our head. So there's this urgency in excelling right away. And like, I gotta do this. I gotta do this. And sometimes you have technical requirements, you know, you need a paycheck for certain things to cover bills and whatever your requirements are, but you will excel at a faster rate than you think. But you're not behind. You're not behind. They're made up benchmarks that are just that. They're made up. And you just took a different path than some other folks. And don't use social media or Facebook as a measuring stick, you know, because that's people put what they want to put on there, not what reality is. So I know, talking, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah, dangerous to use social media as a yardstick, yeah. For sure. For sure. Well, great advice. Thank you, Derek. What, if anything, didn't we cover today that you'd still like to relate to listeners, either vets or those looking to connect with them?
I think we covered a lot. And I just want to say thank you for having me. And I really, really enjoyed the discussion. And, you know, you can find me on LinkedIn and other places like that if you want to connect, or if I can be a valued service members, I'd be happy to connect and find the time. Might take some time to connect, but I'll do what I can to have a conversation if you want it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot too. It sounds like you have like almost the dream job there.
Yeah,
I mean, pretty darn cool.
I'm a very, very lucky person, and I get to work with some amazing people doing a mission that I absolutely love. So I have an enormous amount of gratitude for the things in my life.
Fantastic. Well, you've made it a long way from, you know, a semi-orphan 13-year-old. You yeah. should be proud of where you are. I'm proud to be talking to you and really appreciate it, Derek. Thank you. You've already told us how people can get a hold of you on LinkedIn. You're out there. You've got the website and everything. So that's great. So before we close out, I'd like to give a couple short notes to our listeners. First, I want to personally invite you to join us in Milwaukee in September of 2025, the 8th and the 9th, for Mobius Connect Live. It's a one-of-a-kind event packed with real-world applications and valuable connections with fellow CBM practitioners and reliability professionals. I'll be hosting a special live episode of Veterans Connected at the end. So, Derek, maybe you'll want to come to Milwaukee. I know that John is from Milwaukee, so already said he might want to come up for that. Maybe we'll have a panel. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to go, but it'll be fun nonetheless. And mark your calendars. Register now. Can't wait to see you there in Milwaukee. Second, we're trying to round out our show, seeking more female veterans as well as recently transitioned vets. I mean, it's only been 6 years for you, Derek, right? So that's really recent in the cast of characters we've had on so far. But we want to understand, you know, real time, you know, what it's like and what recommendations you have. So if you know of anybody, please bring them on and we'll have them on the show. So that'll wrap it up to you. Today, thank you, Derek, and thank you, Mobius, for providing this platform to help both transitioning vets as well as those looking to hire them in the field of maintenance and reliability. Thanks, bro.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Veterans Connected. We'll see you back for another episode very soon. In the meantime, we hope to see you in the Veterans Connected community group, where you can meet Eric and fellow podcast guests and share with other industry veterans at MobiusConnect.com. We hope to see you there.